predictions for 2019, working conditions at Amazon, what to make of Apple's letter to shareholders, and the consequences of online hate. All that and more on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 64, recorded Thursday, January 3rd, 2019.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at linkedin.com/technews and get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply.
And by Grammarly. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently by going to grammarly.com/TNW and get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today.
And by Hover. Register a domain name with Hover and build your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and save 10% off your first purchase. Hello!
Happy New Year! Did you know? It's a new year.
Yes, it's a new year. Tech News Weekly, new show. Now we're a morning show.
The morning zoo.
Yes. Yeah, the morning zoo.
All sorts of sound effects that we have planned for you to... No, I'm not
I know. Same show. We talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell.
It is a new year. Everyone is making predictions about what that means. But tech writer and podcaster Omar Gayaga is looking back at his predictions from 2018 and seeing what came true and what did not. Welcome back to the show, Omar.
Hey, good to be here.
So what was the biggest prediction that you made last year that did not come true at all?
I thought we were going to find a way to... lick this whole password thing. Like, surely someone was going to come up with a elegant way to, to figure out our password issues and find a way that we're not coming up with these gajillion character ones. I thought that was going to be a big shift this year. And it just didn't happen. And also I thought that I didn't think blockchain was going to have as troublesome a year as it did. I thought it was going to kind of chug along and become more established, and really toward the end of the year, we just saw people kind of freaking out over Bitcoin prices and blockchain, and sort of. And now I feel like there's going to be more of an exodus the first half of this year as people sort of shake out of that industry. So those were the two that I feel like I was the most off.
I was just going to say, of course, the people who are really into kind of the cryptocurrency and into blockchain will tell you that there's nothing to freak out about, right? Like, this is normal. This is the direction that things head. You're smart if you stay in. Do you buy that? Do you think this is an opportunity year for people going into 2019?
Yeah. What I'm seeing is blockchain people, the hardcore people saying, like, no, this is good. This is going to shake out all of the non-believers and all of the people that are just in it for money, that it's going to be good for the people that are going to be in it for the long haul. So yeah, I think for them, they are celebrating that, you know, all the Johnny come latelys are going to be shaken out of the tree from this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the problem with all these predictions, right? Like, it's like a lot of people are comparing blockchain to the internet, you know, the beginning of the internet. No, people doubted that too. And, you know, people doubted Twitter and people doubted Google. And, you know, so there's always that, those people that are like, you just wait. So you run the Twitter account Omar Stradamus.
So
you did make some predictions that did come true. Which ones did come true?
I definitely that we were going to see. I mean, this was a pretty obvious one, but that we were going to see more of the Alexa and Google Home type stuff appearing in more devices, that it was going to be more widespread than just what Amazon and Google is doing. So, you know, we're starting to see it in car devices. We're starting to see it in, other speakers not made by Amazon. So that whole emergence of voice tech going wider, going into more devices, into more places. I mean, we started to see that like probably two CESs ago. But I think this last year was really when we started to see actual product that you could buy at the store and that was useful. I mean, I think definitely in the last maybe 3 or 4 years, all of the Alexa and Google Home stuff, that's been to me probably the most exciting segment of definitely of home tech or any of the Internet of Things stuff. It's making all that stuff we thought 5 years ago was going to happen. It's finally starting to happen largely on the backs of those technologies.
Yeah, and I mean, the popularity of that has only reached the level that it has because the price of these entry level like hubs, be it the Echo, be it the Google Home Mini or whatever, they're so low. And I mean, even around the holidays, they were pushed even lower that it kind of didn't make sense not to get one because for like $20, you could get one of these suckers. And who knows if it's useful now? It probably is, but it'll definitely be useful down the line as people get more and more interested in this smart home. So you think that's going to continue into 2019?
Yeah. And I mean, this was the first year, though, that I started to hear people say, maybe I shouldn't give that as a gift. Maybe that's not a good thing to give a listening device to a person that doesn't have that in their home already. I started to hear people doubt, like, maybe it's like giving someone a pet. Like, that's maybe they don't want it.
Right.
But what I'm also seeing is people buying their second and third, you know, Echoes or Minis. You know, if they have a Google Home, they're buying a Mini for another room, for the spare room or for the office. So I'm starting to see multiple devices. Or if you have like an Amazon Show, you know, for the kitchen, you might have put that, you know, that's what I did this year. I got gifted a Show and I ended up putting my old Echo in the bedroom just so I'd have music in there. So I think we're starting to see homes that have multiple ones of these. And who's really missing out on this boat is surprisingly is Apple. Like, you don't see people flocking to the HomePod, and that's really the only, you know, Siri-enabled device like it. So yeah. I think Apple this next year is probably going to push harder into that and maybe come out with some lower-priced alternatives to the HomePod, kind of more along the lines of the $99 version.
Well, I agree. No one should surprise anyone with a gift of a pet. I think of these devices as gifts more like fruit cakes. Like, some people love fruit cake and other people just don't want it and they're just going to pass it on. Like, I bet a lot of
lottery gifting
devices got regifted. I'm sure that there's like one little Echo Dot that's just been passed around maybe all over the world. Perhaps.
Or, you know, you get the Amazon credit. It's very easy to send stuff back to Amazon.
True. Yeah. Okay, here's a prediction that you made for next year. Netflix getting into sports. What would that look like?
Yeah, and I've sort of, that's been an ongoing prediction that I've been wrong about for the last like 2 years. But I really think it's bubbling up because as I've heard it described by other people, like anywhere where there's money to be made by Netflix, anywhere where they can sort of eat your lunch, they're going to go there. And we're already starting to see like Hulu get into some live events. So I think that's a natural progression for Netflix, is just get into something like soccer or maybe boxing. You know, HBO has sort of exited that. So that leaves an opportunity for them. So I don't think we're going to see like a massive NFL deal for Netflix this year, but I do think they're going to start experimenting with some live sports, live concerts, more stuff like that. You know, I think their big New Year's thing was the Taylor Swift concert. I would not be surprised if next New Year's, it's a live show. So I think definitely sports and live music are going to be two areas that Netflix will explore this year.
And not too unprecedented to think that Netflix could go in that direction. Amazon's already doing that, right? If you have an Amazon Prime account, you get Thursday night live NFL games, which I didn't even realize until halfway through the season. I was like, oh, wait a minute, this streaming service that I've never thought of as like a live TV sort of thing actually is in this regard, and that brings an incredible amount of value to that. I'm sure that drives people to the service. So it would be really kind of surprising if Netflix didn't do this at some point.
Yeah, it's kind of like when Twitter started, hey, we're going to put NFL games on Twitter, and everybody's like, really? Why? Right. Why would you do that? But they did it. So, I mean, yeah, I think Netflix is kind of the holdout. But, you know, they've got gobs and gobs and truckloads of money and can do it. So I think they will probably start. And you know, for them, something like soccer, they're so big internationally that they could definitely, not even just bypass the U.S. and start doing that in other countries and see how it goes and then bring it here. So I could definitely see that happening.
Yeah.
Where can you watch live soccer now? Is there like is there any app that has that, or is it just regular TV?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I mean, I'm sure like if you go through the FIFA app, they have, you know, links to things. But I, you know, when it's not World Cup, that's so under the radar. So I'm not sure. I'm not a huge soccer fan, but I mean, I have friends that are, and I'm sure they would know where to watch that stuff. And I mean, I know like I think DirecTV has like international packages that have like, you know, soccer for the hardcore.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll get lots of emails. Yeah, we'll have an answer within the hour, I hope. So foldable phones, that's a big one that we've been hearing about for a long time. Do you think that I'll have one in my pocket by the end of the year?
I don't know if you'll want to buy one. Like, it's one of those things, like, are you really going to buy the first generation version of this or wait till they kind of refine it? But I do think there will be a mass market phone, probably from Samsung. I mean, that seems to be the one who's leading the charge. I think in October, there was a Wall Street Journal story about Samsung developing this, and there's other phone makers as well. I think Huawei is looking at this. But the advantage of a foldable phone is you get more screen real estate in something that you can still stick in your pocket. So you could have something that's like the screen size of a mini tablet, but still be able to put it in your pocket or carry it around like a regular size, say, iPhone. So that's sort of the dream of it. But so far, the prototypes that we've seen or the ones that have kind of bubbled up have been sort of ridiculed and not really received very well. So it would have to be something that really combines the best of both worlds, all the stuff that you kind of already expect out of your smartphone, but in a package that has a larger screen and can be, you know, is bendable that you could take it with you.
Meanwhile, sometimes I have a hard time thinking about like that being the thing that catches. On the flip side of that, I'm almost like, maybe it's not foldable phones, but maybe it is full phones that fold, like flip phones, because people want to strip back and they don't want necessarily a phone that does everything. They want to minimize, go the minimalist approach. But I don't know how many people are actually going to go in that direction. Talk about Bitcoin a little bit. I guess we kind of already did, so let's not do that. Let's do AI instead. What about AI? This has been a huge last couple of years for AI, and obviously that's not going to peel back any.
It is, and it's become like this big buzzword. And some of the predictions I'm seeing is consolidation in that industry. Is people saying, you know, this was a big buzzword, and every big tech company started getting into this. And, you know, we're starting to see that not all of them are making money or finding ways to really make any progress on some of these areas. So you'll probably see it like with the Bitcoin and blockchain stuff, you'll see some shakeout of some of these companies going away or some of these companies, you know, kind of retrenching their investments and saying, maybe we don't invest so much in AI. But the thing I think on the social side is more of a backlash of people, like I said, with the Amazon Echo stuff earlier, is people getting a little bit more freaked out when this stuff starts to overreach, of people kind of saying, do I really want these devices and these services knowing this much about me? I think you'll start to see a recalibration of, you know, people saying this stuff is going a little too far. Maybe I don't want this much of it in my life. And then we're seeing with all these congressional hearings, you know, I think they're going to be under the microscope with Congress. I think Facebook, Google, all these companies that collect all this data over, you know, AI-enabled devices, I think there's going to be some pressure on that side too. So I don't know that we're going to see huge strides this year, because I think there's going to be more caution and more rethinking of like how much of this stuff do we want in our lives, and do we want to maybe take a step back and think about this a little bit.
So we're going to talk a little bit later in the show about Apple, the big Apple news yesterday, the letter to investors, the lowering the revenue forecast. But do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, do you think that we are going to be buying fewer phones, upgrading less often? I know last year you predicted that phone camera quality would lead people to keep upgrading because the camera was getting better and better. Based on the news yesterday, do you have any thoughts on what might happen with how quickly we upgrade our phones?
Yeah,
I think that's definitely the case. I mean, my last phone purchase was an iPhone XS specifically because of the camera, because I wanted, you know, the dual cameras, and that was the reason, you know, I gave myself permission to upgrade. But it seems like with the Apple stuff, a lot of it has to do with China. A lot of it has to do with the trade war that's happening, and you know, it seems to have, just based on some comments I saw Tim Cook make this morning, it seems like the whole China trade war situation really took Apple by surprise and was not anticipated. So that seems to be a lot of where they took the hit, is these sort of political moves and these things that happened that are outside of the realm of just me and you buying phones. I think that there's definitely some issues with China that Apple is dealing with that affected that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Omar, thank you so much for joining us. Omar Gayaga is a technology reporter, a podcaster. He can be found at TechMinuteTexas.com and Omar G on Twitter and Omar Stradamus on Twitter.
Don't forget Omar Stradamus.
Love it.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Omar.
Thanks. Always great to talk to you. Appreciate it.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. After the break, all your holiday gifts from Amazon might have come on time, but at what cost? We'll talk about how employees are fighting bad working conditions and trying to unionize. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. You've got the whole new year ahead of you. Can you see it out in the distance? This means this is a great time to set goals for you and your business. Making the perfect hire can help set up your team for success. But where the heck do you find that person? You post your job where people go every day to make connections, grow in their career, and discover job opportunities. You know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about LinkedIn. When most people think about looking for a job, the first place they go is LinkedIn, not some random job board. They go and they start updating their LinkedIn profile and looking around at their connections. 9 out of 10 LinkedIn members say they're open to and interested in new opportunities, just like yours. With most of the U.S. workforce on LinkedIn, posting on LinkedIn is the best way to get your job opportunity in front of the right people, people with the right skills and the right background for your role, people who are ready for something new. Here is a crazy stat. I read this. I couldn't believe it, but I checked it. And it's true. Every 8 seconds, someone hires for a new job on LinkedIn. I think also every 8 seconds, someone is born. So that's the same. It's crazy. LinkedIn is the best way to find the person who will help grow your business. Find the right people for your business this year at LinkedIn.com/tech news and get $50 off your first job post. That's LinkedIn.com/tech news to get $50. 50 big ones, $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn.com/tech news.
All right. So if you hadn't heard, Amazon is big, really big, to the tune of 613,000 employees around the world. 713,000 if you include the temporary holiday workers that from this season. With all this employment, workers are raising the red flag about working conditions within the company. We've been hearing about this for a long time, particularly the conditions found in many of its fulfillment centers. Joining us to talk about how employees are seeking to improve those conditions is Michael Sainato, contributor to The Guardian. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here today. We really appreciate it. So Amazon's seen explosive growth year after year. It's no new story year after year. We're just used to it at this point. Talk a little bit about how that growth may have like affected its employees directly, that rapid growth. How does that translate to employee conditions?
Well, that rapid growth is really put on to employees, and Amazon is one of their hiring practices has been to hire not directly but through temporary workers or third-party workers, and that is within the labor market, that's just a recipe for deteriorating working conditions and exploitation, because those temporary agencies, they want to keep labor costs down as much as possible. And they do that by driving down wages, driving down benefits, and cutting corners wherever they can. So the recent unionizing push, there have been efforts at Amazon to unionize, but over the past 6 months, I think it's the first I've seen in the U.S. at fulfillment centers. In 2000, the CWA tried to unionize a call center at Amazon, and Amazon responded by shutting down the call center. And a few years ago, maintenance workers tried to unionize, and Amazon hired a union busting firm, and the workers wound up voting against forming a union after a really brutal campaign led by that firm against unionization. And we've seen just a few months ago, with Whole Foods, that Amazon union busting video that I reported on, Gizmodo reported on, we received copies of, where managers are trained to push back and basically bust unions and prevent union activities from forming. And there's been a lot of talk about the monopolization of Amazon and their rapid growth. their workforce has more than doubled over the past few years. With that explosive growth and the rapid turnover, Pig Scale rated Amazon the second most employee turnover in the United States in terms of their rankings for the worst companies. And that's part of that reason is the grueling conditions. Workers, they have to hit a rate every hour. And there's a lot of pressure within that environment to hit that rate. And workers who either get injured or can't keep up with the pace or, can't keep up with that pace week after week after week, they fall out of that system.
So you're talking specifically about the job of the picker. Can you talk a little bit about what pickers do exactly?
Pickers, basically, they'll pick the item that needs to be delivered that someone orders from the warehouse and give it to a robot. And from my understanding, it's pretty across the board. It's a very monotonous, very quick paced. In the Staten Island, they have to pick an item every 7 seconds. So you're constantly, moving up and down, back and forth. Often above the ground. One of the workers I spoke with a few months ago, which was a really big story because she, as a picker, she was, three stories above the ground. All the robots are down the floor. And she had a brush car in front of her that's supposed to be like a safety mechanism, and it was broke, and she kind of had to remaneuver how she was picking the items, and that's she wound up hurting her back, and from that she had to deal with workers' compensation issues with Amazon, where they were reluctant to give her that, and she wound up getting kicked out of her apartment and was homeless living out of her car. So that was a big story. And I've spoken with a lot of Amazon workers who have gone through similar situations where they've gotten injured and they've had to struggle with trying to get proper medical care and proper compensation after those injuries as pickers. It's no secret that working in a warehouse is a very physically demanding job. But when you include all the fast-paced working conditions and the emphasis on rate, it's the reason why these fulfillment centers have AmCare medical triage centers within their fulfillment centers, because workers are getting injured all the time.
Wow. So, obviously you write about how, they're working these long hours. I don't know if they're directly asked to skip bathroom breaks, but it turns out that that's what they feel they have to do in order to keep up with the demands of the job. Is there any incentivization around this, or and if there isn't, and they're actually being asked to kind of bypass their own health in order to kind of keep up with the pace of everything, is Amazon breaking any rules, any laws in that regard? Have they been called to question on that?
They're really skirting the laws in it because from what I've spoken with workers that they don't explicitly say you can't go to the bathroom, but what they do is they'll time workers on bathroom breaks. I've had workers tell me this, that managers have said to their face, I'm timing you after they've come back from bathroom break. And another thing is if you have a certain rate that you have to hit every hour, you don't have the time to because in many instances the bathroom isn't right behind there. You have to walk 5 minutes to get to the bathroom in these very large roughly anywhere from a million square feet to 2 million square feet giant warehouses. So going to the bathroom, it's time consuming. So to take out 5 to 10 minutes out of your hour, you are risking not hitting that rate. And I've had other workers tell me that because they track things like bathroom breaks, it's called a time off task, and you can get points. They have a point system where if you get time off task points, that could eventually lead to your termination. And they recently got rid of, with the $15 minimum wage increase, they recently got rid of bonuses where they had these bonus incentives for workers who didn't use their paid time off, took overtime shifts, things like that. But they got rid of that and kind of rolled that into the $15 minimum wage.
So you talked about the pickers handing the item to a robot. Are these jobs that we're talking about jobs that are really in danger of being eliminated through automation? And is that what role does that play in this whole story?
I mean, that's obviously been a concern a lot of people have talked about over the years. As these robots and the technology gets better and better, and more sophisticated, there is, and I've covered stories where communities have pushed back against fulfillment centers being built because they've had these concerns that, yeah, you say you're going to bring all these different jobs, but what are those jobs going to be here in 5 years because of automation? You say you're going to give us a 1,000 jobs, but that could likely get cut to 200. I don't think it's going to get to a point where it's going to be completely robot, automated. There are going to be humans that need to work side by side with robots and to work on the maintenance and everything. But that is definitely a concern where Amazon really pushes this whole we're creating jobs, which there was a study by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance that for every $10 million in sales, Amazon employs 21 people, while the average local brick-and-mortar retail store for the same amount of money employs 49 people. So as Amazon grows and eliminates competitors within the retail market, they are minimizing the jobs in that industry. So you see all these different retail and department stores closing down or reducing their retail store presence. That's having an impact on the economy in terms of what's happening to those jobs and where those jobs are going.
Now, speaking of Amazon's kind of expansion, obviously, we've been talking the last couple of months about their kind of HQ pursuits. They stand to gain a lot from taxpayer funded subsidies while they're moving into, these new locations in New York and North Virginia with those new HQ hubs. Is there any risk to those subsidies at all? So considering that's coming from the government, government funding, if the company, if Amazon is kind of proven to be mistreating its workers in that regard?
Well, I think at this point, it's not a secret how Amazon treats its workers. And I think a lot of people would like to see those subsidies, people get rid of. I think with a lot of the activists and organizing has been put on politicians to stop giving Amazon those large subsidies. And it's not even just with the headquarters. Every time there's a fulfillment center, there's, I live in upstate New York, and there's a fulfillment center proposed just 20 minutes away that they're supposed to build soon. And there's $8 million in subsidies at least just for a fulfillment center. It's socialism for corporations in a sense. And, there is a lot of public resentment towards that for good reason. But unfortunately, most of the politicians in charge haven't been reluctant at all to stand up to Amazon. You see a small few with Bernie Sanders and Ro Khanna leading the way to push Amazon to raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour. But they're really politically there isn't much going on in terms of politicians who have the power to actually stand up and start revoking those subsidies. But I think that the trend will likely lead to that because as Amazon is getting bigger and bigger, there is a greater public backlash to that rapid growth and how it treats its workers and what that means for our society and our economy. Just an example for in terms of the political backlash, the city of Tempe, Arizona, a couple months ago, they voted to stop purchasing any city purchases through Amazon, and they went from spending over $200,000 a year on Amazon through public and city expenses, and they're going towards nothing. And hopefully more cities will pick up on that, and local businesses I think are starting to push back on local and city councils to say you need to start helping people that like us in your local economy rather than trying to win over and bend over backwards for Amazon.
Yeah. But it's super complex too, because I mean obviously people are voting with their wallets, and I mean this holiday season alone Prime sales numbers were off the charts, so it ends up being the trade-off, right? People want their products cheap, they want it fast. And look, this is how Amazon chooses to get there, for better or for worse, and it's not a good thing. So I think it forces people to kind of look in the mirror and reevaluate, like how much is this worth to you?
And it's also, other companies are doing this too.
Oh, yeah,
like other
absolutely.
Retailers, there are lots of fulfillment centers that are doing the same thing, and they're trying to keep up with Amazon.
So, yeah.
Like if you look into places like XPO Fulfillment, I think it's called, like they have horrible working conditions because they're trying to keep up with Amazon.
Amazon's setting the gold standard, right, of what you can do in that regard. Yeah. Michael Sainato, it's a pleasure getting you on today. Thank you so much for taking time to chat with us about this. Where do you want people to follow you online?
They can follow me. They can look my name on Facebook or my Twitter account msainot1, on a weekly basis at the very least. My stories are on labor issues or in the Guardian, so you can check that out as well.
Awesome. Yeah, and you're writing for a number of publications. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it, and Happy New Year.
All right, Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
Take care. All right, coming up, Apple lowered its quarterly guidance. We referred to that just a few minutes ago earlier in the show. But what does it actually mean? Renee Ritchie is going to join us to talk about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Grammarly. Grammarly is fun, it's smart, and it's optimistic. Those are all great things. They encourage everyone, even the best students and top professionals, to use Grammarly to do their best work and accomplish even more of their goals. Grammarly is a writing assistant, and it's going to make you look and sound smarter than you already are. You can start off the new year by easily improving yourself and your communication at school, at work, and almost anywhere with Grammarly, because it works everywhere. They help people show their best self through writing and are available cross-platforms, including online browser extensions that you can install, desktop editor, a mobile keyboard checker so you get it on your mobile phone. Grammarly is available in all browsers, so Chrome, Firefox, Safari, Edge, and like I said, platforms. So you get it on iOS, Android, Windows, Mac, wherever you happen to be doing your work. Their free product reviews critical spelling and grammar, and then Grammarly Premium looks out for spelling and grammar, of course, plus advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, and readability for different occasions. So if you're writing for a business proposal versus an academic essay or maybe just a casual blog post, it can inform you around those. You can accomplish your goals with the help that you receive from Grammarly, so you stop making those easy-to-use email typos on your phone. You can maybe close more deals at work with your emails because they actually read the way someone wants to read them. You can polish your resume to make sure that you get that new job and that you impress. It's just a wonderful service. I have it running on all my devices and it's saved me so many times. So help it save you. All you have to do is go to grammarly.com/TNW. You'll get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. That's grammarly.com/TNW. And doing that, you're going to get 20% off your Grammarly premium account. And we thank Grammarly for their support. So for the first time since 2002, Apple yesterday issued a press release to investors where it revised its guidance for the first 2019 quarter, effectively lowering it below the original estimate. And because this is Apple we're talking about here, everyone, including the market, lost its ever-loving mind. Joining us to help everyone take a deep breath and calm down a little bit is Renee Ritchie from iMore. Megan's over there meditating. Have you meditated around this yet, Renee?
Yeah, I am entirely in a Megan-like Zen state. And just good air in, bad Twitter out.
Right. I block bad, harness good.
I don't own any Apple stock, by the way. So just so we know.
But it's Apple we're talking about here. So first, you know, news hit of this yesterday. It seemed like everybody was given their quick, rapid succession hot takes almost immediately. What was your initial take?
Oh, just for that was amazing because everybody used every pet peeve or personal gripe. They suddenly had a way to justify it. It's like, I knew Apple jettisoning the floppy drive in the original iMac was going to come back and bite them, and it finally has. And it was just, it must have been so cathartic. It was quasi-beautiful, quasi-terrifying to watch.
So, obviously, you know, we wake up this morning, we kind of see the effects on the stock. The stock has taken a pretty sizable hit. And you have to admit, like, this is a really big deal for Apple. Obviously, the company itself isn't on fire, but this is one of Apple's biggest disappointments in the modern iPhone era that we can talk about. Where is all of this trouble coming from? Apple made a big point about this being largely around their business in China. What's the bottom line there?
So there are a lot of symptoms, and I think there's a root cause to all of it. The symptoms are everything from what Apple said, which is China. There was almost like a perfect negative storm in China where everything from the trade and tariff problems that these two authoritarian and unpredictable governments are suddenly finding themselves in, to the Chinese economy going down, to some spirit of nationalism in China, and very strong competitors like Huawei who are in the market. There's also, to some extent, you know, people use WeChat and say that's the platform in China, and it makes it easier to switch between devices and between manufacturers. Although Apple services numbers were up and their install base was up, which means that Apple does enjoy, I think, a little more stickiness than your average brand does in China. But that's sort of the China story. And then Tim Cook also said there was some softness in upgrades in North America, and that he attributed in part to the iPhone battery replacement program. iPhone battery awareness was very low and price was high previously, but as of 2018, awareness went through the roof and prices went right to the bottom, and a lot of people got a battery replacement instead of buying a new iPhone. And then you could throw in high iPhone prices for the XS. Also, some people who just don't want to give up their home button or are just happy to ride it out. There's no more cell phone companies subsidizing prices. So the sticker shock is much bigger than it had ever been before. And you had almost like another perfect little storm in North America. But I think both of those things, like I said, are symptoms. And the actual thing is that we've reached the stage of smartphones where almost everybody who wants one has one and is relatively happy with the one that they have.
Yeah.
So you bring up this WeChat thing, which is so interesting to me. So what you're saying is because most people communicate on WeChat, then, which is cross-platform, it's very easy to go back and forth. And so to switch from an iPhone to an Android phone is not as difficult. I mean, is that, like you mentioned that first, is that really, I mean, more weighted in this than the other things? Because, I mean, that's what I always think anecdotally, like I could never switch to an Android because of iMessage. But is that really true?
Yeah, to a certain extent. For example, people in China use WeChat for everything. It is their iMessage. It is their Apple or Google Pay. They use it for every transaction, for every interaction. And that means that if you get a different phone, whether you switch from ZTE to Huawei or you switch from Apple to another manufacturer, your instance of WeChat just goes with you. So the barrier to switching is much less than it is in a country where, you know, the rest of the world is still iOS versus Android and iMessage and WhatsApp. There are a lot more barriers, like everything you bought on Google Play versus everything you bought on the App Store. And the Chinese economy is just not that tied to a platform. But again, I would be more worried, but Apple's number for services is growing. And that, I think, is a counterindication. And the number of installed units is growing. So I think Apple first is seen as a luxury brand. You get face, you get esteem for owning Apple. But also, I think Apple is getting some buy-in to their services, which previously might not have been the case.
Now, when I look at Apple's struggles in China, which, you know, like we've discussed, was a large part of Tim Cook's kind of write up around why they were lowering these expectations. It's striking to me that Apple as a company has these challenges, but that this could be a greater warning for a whole lot of other companies, right? Could this be the interpretation that if Apple is having a challenge in China, you know, where obviously there's a huge market there to be tapped into, that everybody else should also be really concerned about this if Apple can't make it work?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, we've already seen a big shakeout in phones. It got to the point where only Apple and Samsung really make money in smartphones. There are some people who make a little bit of money, but the vast majority of money is made by Apple first and then Samsung, and everyone else either spent other money to subsidize their entry into the market, like Microsoft using Windows and Office profits for a long time with Windows Mobile, or they folded, like what happened with Palm and, you know, the troubles that Nokia and BlackBerry have gone through. So it has never been a high profit business, and that's always made it slightly dangerous. But when you look at the numbers, like Apple is down, Samsung is probably going to be down as well. It does show that it's no longer sort of the fire everything, growth, huge success, we're making more money than oil companies story that it was for a while in the past.
So I've heard some people online just basically say it's as simple as this, and you brought this up a little bit too. They raised the price of all the phones. It's very high, and fewer people bought them. It's basic economics. What's the surprise? Talk about that take.
Yeah, I think that's another case of, you know, people taking what they feel and then sorting facts to support that. And I think it's a lot more nuanced than that. It's the same as the WeChat story. There's all sorts of things. Some people are still saying, hey, it's the headphone jack, man. If they hadn't got rid of the headphone jack, they'd be flying high. So it's whatever personally bugs you. And if you're offended by higher prices, and I think there's certainly a case to be made that they did overprice all of these phones. I think that's true, but I don't know if that's an exact causation effect here. Because for a lot of people, the prices are, you know, especially in the U.S., they can be amortized over subscription programs. Internationally, it's been very bad because the U.S. dollar is so strong. So prices in Canada, the U.K., other countries are astronomically higher. And that Apple did mention. They did mention the foreign exchange was a huge factor to them. Overall, Apple is in a bit of a sticky situation there because Apple is not making iPhones more expensive. Apple is making more expensive iPhones. Everything from the OLED screens to the true depth camera modules are much more expensive than the old LCD screens, the old Touch ID, the old front-facing cameras. They're also components have gone up substantially over the last few years, and Apple's prepaid for a lot of those. But when the prepay runs out, they have to start paying again, and their prices go up. And if you look at what Apple's guided, it's also guided margins down. And margins are down about 2% since the height of the Steve Jobs era, which, you know, some people are like, oh, Tim Cook just wants to milk all the profits out of the industry at the expense of market. He is making less profit. He's making much bigger volume, but he's making less profit than Steve Jobs did historically. So I think that is a factor. It's absolutely a factor. Sticker shock is real. But I think it's, again, an example of the problem of just everybody. If you're still desperate for an iPhone, you could probably justify it. But if your iPhone is pretty good, if you're pretty happy, then it's harder to say I'm going to pay $1,000 for another iPhone.
Yeah, I think that's a really big consideration, not just for Apple, you know, Apple's iPhones, but phones in general. We've gotten to this point where things are like, it's such a commodity at this point. Like, you know that your phone is probably going to be good enough to do all of the things. 5 years ago, you could name off the top of your head all the ways that your phone sucks. But now when you get it, yes, it's really good, and not just for that year. It's good for 2 years, 3 years, and it becomes more and more difficult to justify not only replacing it, but replacing it with the new normal of the price point of $1,000. And so those factors combined, that's a pretty potent potent thing to go up against.
We're not used to the price of technology going up. We've all lived in an era where technology was invented and is now quickly growing. And we're used to technology forcing prices down. Our house prices don't go down. Our car prices don't always go down. We pay incredible amounts of money for bottles of water and for, you know, lattes. But we're not used to paying a lot for technology. And as it matures, those market conditions are going to be different. And it's not going to continue to race down. And we're going to have to face either what we consider to be a good enough phone or what we're willing to pay to be a good enough phone, which isn't the device that most of us use for like 8 hours a day, every day, all year, compared to a lot of other things we pay a lot of money for.
Yeah.
So I want to get back to all of this analyst doom and gloom and, you know, the stock market. When people come out with these things that aren't based on fact, I'm not talking about just random people Twittering or tweeting, but but just people like true analysts that are saying these things are not based on fact. How is that not illegal market manipulation?
I think it really should be. I mean, we had Cramer has admitted to it in the past that if he hasn't made his shorts, he calls up, starts a rumor. Apple Publications are happy, or previously BlackBerry Publications were happy to jump on it. It would drive down the stock price. He'd short and he'd make his quarter. And like he said that on tape. It's on YouTube. You can go look at it. And I don't know why that's not investigated. I don't know why the funds aren't investigated. But it does create problems because this quarter, we saw people say that Apple's sales were down. And it's gotten to the point where they didn't get believed automatically. Last year, there was panic and it turned out to be wrong. And for quarter after quarter before that, for years and years, there were, you know, Verizon's not going to take the iPhone. The iPhone is not down. Apple's not going to make their numbers. The supply, and it was never true. And now finally it's true and nobody believed it. And that hurts the investors as much as the fake stories of Apple being under beleaguered or sieged hurt them previously.
So at this point, obviously, there's going to be a lot of eyeballs on Apple to see like what they can do to right the ship if it needs righting. What do you believe? What is the best approach for Apple at this stage of the game?
One of the biggest factors, I think, is that the iPhone is a absolutely huge distortion. It destroys any or most rational takes on Apple because the iPhone makes so much money. It makes more money than companies that are in control of very scarce fossil fuel resources. When you start to look at Apple, like what's the next iPhone? It's unclear there is a next iPhone for Apple or for anybody. Like until the next miraculous wearable technology or cybernetic implants become something that everybody simply has to have, there's just not going to be another iPhone. But if you take the iPhone away and you look at the other businesses, you look at everything from Mac to iPad to Apple Watch to AirPods to services, there's a lot of fundamentally really good, really high-performing businesses there. And I think if you look at Apple's behavior over the last 4 or 5 years, they weren't fooled by their own success. They knew that peak iPhone was coming. And they realized that once you can't sell iPhones anymore, you have to sell things to people who have iPhones. And that's why we see AirPods and Apple Watch, I think, taking off and why Apple is making a bigger play into services. And all of those businesses, I think Cook said overall, they were up 19%. And they're having record services business, even in China and in other parts of the world. And even with this huge hit, this is still going to be the second best quarter in the history of Apple, which has a history of really, really good quarters. Mm-hmm. So I think as long as they're not deluded into thinking they have to necessarily fix iPhone beyond the way a company can legitimately fix it, if they keep investing in everything else that the iPhone enables, then it may not be the Taylor Swift of consumer electronics anymore, but it'll be a bunch of really good-sized rock bands for their future.
Well, Rene Ritchie, it's always awesome to get you on. We appreciate you hopping on to give us your take on this big Apple news. Rene Ritchie, iMore.com. Thanks, man. Happy New Year.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
We'll talk to you soon. Take care, Rene.
After the break, online hate. Who are the people that really suffer? But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Building your online brand has never been more important. Buying a domain name is the first and the biggest step to building your personal brand online. Your domain name tells the online community who you are and what you're passionate about. For example, .tech. Or .fan, or .cat, .organic, .security, .wine, .zone, .golf. There's so many. Web hosts and websites evolve as their brand, website, and hosting needs change. Keeping your domain separate from hosting gives you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business. Now, no one wants to be stuck with a solution that does not meet their needs. Hover has over 400 domain extensions to choose from to help you brand yourself online. Hover offers the best-in-class customer support team and no upsells. Hover Connect allows you to connect your domain name to many website builders with just a few simple clicks. Personalized email that matches your domain name further supports your online identity. Hover has such a clean interface. I love it. Now, I own goatswearingclothes.com, and Hover can also help me buy goatswearingclothes.club, just in case the goats and I wanted to start a club. Or I can also get goatswearingclothes.democrat or goatswearingclothes.republican, supposing the goats and I decided to get political. We probably won't. Don't worry. Hover, our go-to domain name provider, will be celebrating their 10-year anniversary this January. Check out their promos starting January 16th. That will include $10.coms and 99-cent domains. Kick off 2019 with a domain name from Hover. Visit hover.com/twit right now for 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com/twit for 10% off. And we thank Hover for their support. Online hate has been around pretty much since the internet began, but the Washington Post points out that 2018 was the year that the largest internet companies began to measure and disclose how toxic this hate could be. Joining us to discuss this investigation that the Washington Post did into the human experience of online hate is one of the reporters of the story, Jeffrey Fowler. Welcome back to the show, Jeffrey.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Hi, guys.
So you usually join us to talk about robots that kids can build or devices that help senior citizens connect to the internet. This is a little different. Tell us what sparked this investigation.
It's the other side of the technology that we live with. And you know, we at the Post, a whole group of reporters, we just kept talking about all of these stories we were writing about people who were living with hate and had become a major part of their lives. For me personally, it started in March when I was in Parkland, Florida, talking to some of the student survivors of the shooting, the school shooting there, and they talked about how they were dealing with it, how they, you know, had to take protections at home, how their Twitter feeds were filled with all of this vile stuff. And so we wanted to take some time and sort of do a story that looks at the other side of hate. You know, we always do stories about, the haters and the people who are going on the attack. But what does it really feel like to live with this stuff? How does it change your life? How does it change how you think about yourself? How does it change your family and how you feel safe at home? So we went out and, you know, found people who were willing to talk about their lived experience with having people attack them online. We went to a lot of different kinds of people. It was a really broad set of folks we approached. Not surprisingly, many of them would not talk on the record mm-hmm. about their experience. They're fearful that talking about it would bring more hate to them. But we did find these seven who have a pretty wide set of experiences to share and really opened my eyes to the reality that, you know, when you're on Twitter or you're on Facebook or Gab or whatever, and you see, you know, that zing or that clap back, and you think like, oh, it's another good one. Like, there's another experience to what's going on just across the screen.
One of the Parkland survivors that you talked to, Cameron Caskey, I was just so moved by what he said. He said people are addicted to being awful and there's nothing we can do about it. But he also was able to joke about some of the horrible things that people sent to him. Tell us more about Cameron.
You know, that was one of the most difficult interviews I've ever done. He clearly is struggling with what he has to live with every day and the hate that he gets on the internet. And he deals with it. One of his coping strategies is to make jokes about it. And he did that a lot. And he said, you know, at first he just tried to find the sort of the horrible comments, and we have some examples in the piece there. Things people said about his little brother, for example. He just tried to find it kind of funny. But then it started to get serious when people started to make very specific, credible threats against his house where he lives. They started sending SWAT teams to his house. And so he's kind of reached a point where he's resigned to the fact that hate is going to be a part of his life. And it's quite a statement about where we've come as a society, that here's this kid who's 18 and in high school and has already decided that, you know, hate is part of being human.
The anonymity of everything just drives us further and further and makes it so much easier. That's one thing that really struck me about a lot of these interviews is that, and I've heard of this outside of just these interviews as well, is this movement towards putting on a good face about it and being like, yeah, well, you know what? Yeah, it really sucks, but I'm going to do my best to not let it bother me. But what I get concerned with in that regard is that sometimes you don't know or understand what the long-term ramifications of this end up being. What is your life look like 10, 15 years down the line when you've put on a good face in light of this really horrendous stuff? And how does that affect your life going forward? Did they have any insight into how they could, like, live the next 10 years of their life in this new kind of world order on the internet and how that might affect them?
Talking with Cameron Caskey, the kid from Parkland, you know, I said, do you talk with a therapist? Do you think that maybe someday this is going to catch up with you? And he says he thinks in 10 years time, a lot of the Parkland kids are going to have a lot of problems, and they've just, you know, they've only begun to scratch the surface of that. I think that hate, beyond that case, I think hate can really impact people in a lot of subtle ways that can take a long time to sort of manifest themselves. We have a story in there about a cyclist who's a trans person, and you know, won a big race, but then had it ruined by people saying, you know, oh, you don't deserve to win. So you know, you can take the joy out of a victory, and then what does that do to you? To you, as you think about, you know, going on being a cyclist. We told the story of a family in Texas whose son was attacked by bullies in school when he decided to come out as gay on Instagram, and it essentially put him back in the closet, the experience did. And imagine the impact that can have over many years about sort of being proud about who you are.
So you're talking about Ricky Stratton, whose parents are pursuing legal action, and how is that going?
Not very well. That was another really eye-opening thing for me. You know, there's a couple of years ago, many states, including Texas, where they live, developed laws against bullying online, specifically because it can cause kids to commit suicide. But in their case, I learned that it was very, very hard, even though Ricky's mom is a police officer and knows the law and knows how to get justice. She was having a hard time getting the school and local prosecutors to take it seriously and to really use the law to help them get justice. So I think it might be time for another look at those laws and to see if they're really serving the world that we are now all living in.
And you pointed out that, you know, a large part of this was happening on Instagram. Of course, his mom kind of pulled him off Instagram to protect him, to shield him from this stuff. Yet, to a certain degree, this is where a lot of kids are communicating. So at some point, he wants to get back on there. And I think what that did, that really kind of lit a bulb for me around how, you know, I'm a parent, and so I've got a couple of kids, and sometimes, you know, and I have to kind of like push back against the desire or the knee-jerk reaction to say, I don't understand it, therefore I'm going to take it away, or I'm going to prevent them from doing that entirely because when I was a kid, I didn't have that and I grew up just fine. You know, like, I don't want to go into that very familiar parental place necessarily, but I guess my question is does that end up being the right approach, or does that create other problems?
I think you're exactly right. It creates other problems. All of these are complicated stories. Look, if you're a gay teen in Texas, Instagram might be where bullies come and make fun of you, but it's also where you have a community, right? It's where you can find other young gay people and other people who support you. So just running away is not the answer. Interestingly, a lot of these folks we spoke with didn't necessarily think the answer was just to blame these tech platforms either. Many of them actually were unaware that these tech platforms were even talking about hate, talking about the problem. They thought it was just their own problems that they had to deal with. So I think there's a lot of work that can be done there, certainly, you know, by Instagram, by Twitter, by Facebook to work on this stuff. And that's part of the reason why they started gathering numbers on hate this year, to sort of give us at least some kind of index as to how things are developing and changing. But it's really complicated. And but what I learned, it's really messy out there right now.
Yeah.
So one of the double-sided coin that you talked about, that, you know, Instagram being the place where you can meet people you might not have met in the past that are like-minded, and also being the place of bullies, that when you talk to Cameron Caskey, he said he sort of blamed himself a little bit for the hate, it sounded like, and said, you know, their problem, the Parkland kids' problem, was they focused on the people and not the issue. But the focusing on the people was what gained so much. That's what caused the traction, right? That's what people, I know for me, like for so many people, it was just these faces of these high school kids that you're like, wow. So, I mean, how do we deal with that? I mean, because it's like there's so much, I would like to think that there was, you know, net positive in terms of, you know, of us being better people. But I don't know, when you talk about, you know, all these kids having to go to therapy because of the hate they've dealt with.
I think you just summed up the world that we live in right now, right? It's because of the internet, we're able to hear these very personal stories and hear the voices of these kids who went through this. And that has had a profound political impact on the United States. And yet, it is also it became a very personal thing for them. And people decided that just because a kid has a political opinion, that it is okay to attack them personally. That's the point we've reached in our society. And so I think we have to question that. Maybe, you know, in these polarized times, we've really been unable to separate a political point of view from who someone is as a person. And I think that's something that maybe we need to think through differently. But yeah, that is the cost. You know, these kids lived through the darkest day of their lives at school, and then we sent them to battle on the internet.
Yeah, right. And and it's not just the anonymity of it all; it's also just the large scale that these social networks are operating in, and the social media kind of responsibility around that. When a person has a large audience, you know, some of these interviews kind of alluded to the fact that it's very easy for someone with a large audience to, whether they realize it or not, mobilize against or for somebody simply by putting out a single tweet of some sort, and then suddenly this person that made some random comment on the internet is, you know, basically their life is plagued for weeks, months, years, potentially around that. They bear some responsibility around this as well, right? Like, their public message has that power to mobilize. I don't know how any of this is enforced. And I think that's the big trick of all of this, is that how do you enforce it when it's people being people?
Yeah, you brought up a case that I think is one of the most fascinating stories we share in this piece. There's this woman named Juana Thompson, who is a culture writer on the internet, and she earlier in the year tweeted a critique of Nicki Minaj, and it wasn't even that harsh a critique. She was just saying, I kind of wish Nicki would make some more mature content, showing that she's growing up, getting older. But Nicki did not like it, and obliquely sort of responded to her, and Nicki's fans caught on. And then the fan culture of the internet is not just about sort of celebrating things anymore. It became about attacking this woman. Mm-hmm. And she had to live with that. She says, cost her a job, and it cost her people just saying awful things about her. Then they found pictures of her daughter and started photoshopping them. So it was very interesting. And from her perspective, Nicki Minaj shared some of that responsibility. Now, Nicki never expressly said, hello, Barbs, and that's the name of her fans, go attack this woman. But she let it go on, and she saw that it was happening. And with the fan culture on the internet, like, celebrities share some of this power. And I don't know that they've all really thought through what that means and what responsibility comes with it.
And the story of Charlie Wilkins is another one. I mean, you don't even have to say anything or be famous or do anything. I mean, talk a little bit about Charlie Wilkins.
This is a guy who is a professional skateboarder who happens to have the same name as somebody who did something awful, was attacking a 9/11 widow. And when that happened, people confused him for the other person and just started attacking him. And he just couldn't believe what was going on. And at first he started fighting back and saying, wait, no, like, you've got the wrong guy. I also found that horrible. But it didn't really stop the hate flowing at him. So just even a mistaken identity can end up ruining not only your day, your week, your month, your year, but also make you fearful to check your voicemail, fearful that somebody's going to do something crazy at your house.
So can we end this in a positive way?
Guys, I know it's the beginning of a new year, but this is an important topic. We really need to sort of wrestle with the world that we're creating, we're all a part of, and how to treat each other better.
Yeah. I guess just, knowing it's out there, reading these stories is important. You can read the whole piece at the Washington Post. Jeffrey Feller is a technology columnist for the Washington Post. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You bet.
We
Take
appreciate
care.
It. All right. Finally, just a quick tip for you as you set up that new phone that you may or may not have gotten for the holidays and decide that your old phone should rest in peace in the trash. Don't throw it in the trash. Why? Well, there are better ways to dispose of the technology that isn't useful to you, first of all, because it might be useful to someone else. So, donate it to a good cause if it actually still works and stuff. But if you can't bring yourself to be a good Samaritan and you simply must dispose of your old phone, consider that the lithium ion battery inside is incredibly flammable. And that 65, this is kind of the nugget from this article, 65% of fires that happened in California waste facilities last year were caused by those lithium ion batteries. With all that trash ash compacting and shifting and moving around and everything, it becomes super easy for a lithium ion battery to be punctured, ignited, and even explode, which could shut down the facility for days in some cases. So if you can't pawn the device off onto someone who needs it and you must throw it away, you can look for a specialized battery recycling program. You can even take them into Home Depot, Lowe's, Best Buy stores for responsibly recycling them. If you just got a battery and you're throwing it away, they say like wrap it in duct tape or put it into a baggie, like a Ziploc baggie. That way the metal that way metal can't touch the battery, and then close the circuit and pop the battery. But I just thought it was a good reminder that, you know, sometimes it's easy when we're going through the house and we're like, I don't need this anymore, and this is no use to anyone. I'm just throwing it in the trash, or I'll put it in recycling and somebody else will deal with it. They'll find it and, you know, it'll make its way somewhere because out of sight, out of mind. And, I don't know. You could be setting a warehouse on fire and not even know it.
You could do what I do, which is I bring them in here to the office and I give them to Burke, and he deals with them. So if you guys want to just do that, it works for me. So he says he eats them.
Which is interesting.
Okay, so
something new about Burke today.
I have some thoughts because my New Year's resolution, my intention, is to fix things instead of, just getting a new one. And I've been thinking a lot about this. And one thing that you shouldn't do, which is what I do, besides bringing stuff to Burke, but with old phones, you probably do this. So you just put them in a drawer, right? Like, I'm going to deal with it later.
Yes.
Like, that is
ridiculous.
That, aside from just throwing in the trash, that's the second worst thing you can do because they just lose value. And so if you could sell it to someone, I know giving away is great and everything, but if you sell something to someone, that means they really want to use it, right? Like, they're, even if you're going to sell it for just a very small amount, like, just knowing that someone wants to put money to take that phone, that's as long as it works, of course. I think that's important. Now I have a 5C. I don't know if anyone wants to buy that, but if you do, let me know. And an SE. The SE is the one that I'm going to do it this week, sell it, because I know that that still has value to someone. And then not to us, because we're not using it anymore. So I think that's an important thing. So if everyone could go into their drawer, look in their extra phone drawer and try to find someone to buy your phone.
I mean, it's true. Every single day, that phone is less and less, like, carries less value, and not just from a monetary value standpoint, but, you know, as we know, as these devices age over time, they become less useful or less reliable or whatever. So,
right. I mean, I've been
get
saving
it back out there while it's still useful.
Right. I've been saving the SE for when your kids get a phone, but that's years from now. So, they'll be like,
it's going to be a while. Sorry, kids. I realize you asked Santa for a phone this year.
It's my fault. Just blame me.
All right. I'll blame you for everything.
Okay.
Tech News Weekly records live now every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. You can go to twit.tv/, is that right? 11, 12, 1? No, 2 p.m. Eastern. Sorry. At twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
What time is it, UTC?
I don't know.
I don't either. Subscribe to their show at twit.tv/TNW. Then it doesn't matter what time zone you're in. You can watch it whenever you want. And I'm excited. It's what?
1900 UTC.
And I'm excited because this means you can, you know, if you have a commute home, we'll be up and you can, you know, subscribe and then it'll be ready for you on your commute home. And if you want to tweet at me to tell me what time it is, I'm at Megan Maroney.
Yeah, tell me what time it is, too. I could always use a time update. I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Victor. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Jammer B, Colleen, everyone who helps us do the show each and every week. And thanks to you for watching us on our new time. We appreciate it. You're probably subscribed anyway, so the time doesn't matter to you. But anyways, we'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.